What does it take to liquefy natural gas?
If you pour LNG in a glass, in a clear glass, you would be very hard-pressed to tell the difference between that and water. It's that clear.
Here's a hint. It involves temperatures more like Saturn than Earth. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, October 23rd. Good evening, I'm Laurie Townsend. Also tonight, the Arctic Council wraps up its Anchorage meeting.
We actually did something I believe has never been attempted in the history of the Arctic Council, certainly not to my knowledge.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
Tomorrow, lawmakers will gather in Juneau for the start of a special session on the Alaska LNG project, which would carry natural gas from the North Slope down to the Kenai Peninsula for export. If it goes forward, it's expected to cost a whopping $45 to $65 billion, and roughly half of that cost would be a giant liquefaction plant where natural gas is turned into a liquid. In the second half of our series, Breaking Down the Project, APRN's Rachel Waldholtz visited an LNG plant to find out what all the fuss is about.
The Alaska LNG project calls for a giant plant on some 600 acres in Nikiski. And as it happens, there's already a liquefaction plant there, ConocoPhillips Kenai LNG plant. Right now, it's the only plant in North America that exports LNG, and it's been operating in essentially the same way since 1969. Plant manager Ray Chumley gave me a driving tour.
So even though we're only going 5 miles an hour, we still need to put our seatbelts on.
It's a modest-looking operation. Like most hydrocarbon processing plants, it looks essentially like a series of pipes and holding tanks. It's not small, but it's nothing close to the plant required for the Alaska LNG project. At full capacity, this plant can process 1.3 million tons per year. The Alaska LNG project hopes to produce up to 20 million tons per year. But it's still the same basic concept.
So over here to your right is where the actual natural gas comes into the plant via the pipelines.
The gas for the Kenai plant comes from operations in Cook Inlet. On a clear day, you can see the platforms out on the water. It's brought in via pipeline, and first the gas goes through a drying process. It pulls out any last remaining liquids, any carbon dioxide. What you're left with is mostly methane. And that methane then goes into the proverbial black box. Except in this case, it's a white box. Actually, two white boxes with some very technical names.
And I love these boxes. They say cold box A and cold box B. That seems a little bit self-explanatory. What's happening in there?
Well, that is our proprietary process for ConocoPhillips. So that is actually where the liquefaction happens. I can't go into detail on what the process is, but that is where the liquefaction happens.
Chumley can't tell you what's inside because ConocoPhillips is one of the few companies in the world that has this technology. But it's essentially a giant refrigerator, and it chills the gas down to negative 260 degrees Fahrenheit. As it cools, it transforms from a gas into a liquid and shrinks down, becoming 600 times smaller. The end result looks pretty familiar.
If you pour LNG in a glass, in a clear glass, you would be very hard-pressed to tell the difference between that and water. It's that clear. You can see right through the glass. It's like looking at a glass of water.
But what if you touched it?
You can imagine touching something at minus 263 degrees. It would freeze your finger. Absolutely.
Once it's liquefied, the gas has to stay that cold. That means all the pipes and holding tanks have to be made from materials that can withstand that kind of temperature.
Carbon steel won't handle that. It just turns brittle. If you dipped a one-inch piece of carbon steel pipe in a glass of LNG, you can take a hammer and just shatter that piece of pipe after that.
And that's one reason why liquefaction plants are so expensive. Not only do you have to buy the special technology to chill the gas into liquid, you also have to build your plant so it can handle the cold. Everything after the cold box is the cryogenic side of the plant. Yep, cryogenic, as in very, very cold. From the cold boxes, the LNG is piped into three tall storage tanks. But again, these are nothing compared to what's proposed for the Alaska LNG project. These three tanks are equal to one shipload, and the Kenai LNG plant loaded about six ships this year. The Alaska LNG project hopes to load 15 to 20 ships a month. One of those ships is sitting at the end of the jetty.
And it's not a bad view you guys have from this
plant.
No,
it's actually really nice.
Really nice is an understatement. The ship sits with Cook Inlet behind it, framed by the white peaks of the Alaska Range. This ship is essentially a floating thermos, specially designed to transport the LNG across the Pacific to Japan or China. And that's the whole point of liquefying it. If the gas were being transported over land, it could just be fed into a pipeline in gas form. But to fit into a ship or a train or truck, it has to shrink down to liquid form. In fact, once it arrives in Asia, it's warmed up and turned back into gas for use. And it's decisions there that will decide if this project ever goes forward. There likely won't be a final decision on whether to break ground until 2018, and that will depend on whether there's demand for the gas in Asia. If there is, and if all goes according to plan, the Alaska LNG project would ship its first gas in 2024. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waltholz.
Congress has passed a bill to combat pirate fishing. The bill, called the Illegal, Unreported, and Unregulated Fishing Enforcement Act, now goes to the president for his signature. It puts in law the provisions of an international treaty aimed at denying illegal fishing vessels access to a country's ports. The bill was sponsored by all members of the Alaska delegation and supported by Alaska's fishing industry. Its passage was also cheered by conservation groups like the World Wildlife Fund. The bill passed both houses of Congress without opposition. The Arctic Council wrapped up the first major meeting under U.S. chairmanship this week in Anchorage. KSKA's Monica Gokey has a short digest.
During the three-day meeting, Arctic Council officials made the most headway on an effort to mitigate the impacts of black carbon and methane in the Arctic. State Department Deputy Secretary David Bolton chairs the Council's senior-most officials.
These short-lived climate pollutants, particularly black carbon and methane, have cause particular climate-related problems in the Arctic.
Black carbon is particulate waste from fossil fuel combustion. It's black, so when it lands on snow and ice, it draws warmth and accelerates melt. Surprisingly, the Council's observer states also showed a strong interest in the problem. More than half submitted assessment reports of their own emissions. These are nations who do not border the Arctic, but this meeting made it clear that some certainly want a stronger voice on the Arctic Council.
We actually did something I believe has never been attempted in the history of the Arctic Council, certainly not to my knowledge. We spent a half day with the observers at the table, hearing from them. A lot of them have been wanting to have greater engagement, greater input.
The topics they were most interested in, Bolton says, were the Black Carbon Initiative and migratory bird flyways. And speaking of bigger voices on the council, where exactly does Alaska fit in here? Well, there are four voices on the council that represent the indigenous peoples of Alaska. But most of the delegates representing U.S. interests are on State Department payroll in Washington, D.C.
The federal government recognizes that we are an Arctic nation because of Alaska, and we wanted to be in partnership with the state of Alaska and the people of Alaska, too, in carrying out our chairmanship.
Before the U.S. assumed chairmanship of the Arctic Council in April, David Bolton and colleagues made several trips to Alaska, sort of like scouting trips, to hear from Alaskans on what interests they had for chairmanship. The three key objectives the U.S. decided to focus on during its council chairmanship are improving the well-being of Arctic communities, bolstering marine stewardship in the Arctic Ocean, and addressing the impacts of climate change. It's a tall order.
Everything still needs to be worked on. This is a two-year process. We're still in the early stages of it.
The council reconvenes in another 6 months in Fairbanks. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Monica Gokey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Sea Alaska argues for tougher repatriation laws.
In one case, I would say that we expended over $100,000 compiling evidence.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Alaska Pacific University is proud to announce two new bachelor degrees, Alaska Native Governance and Creative and Professional Writing. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
One of the Fairbanks Four passed a polygraph. The results of the lie detector test taken by Marvin Roberts last year were shared during day 13 of an evidentiary hearing being held to consider whether Roberts, George Fries, Kevin Pease, and Eugene Vent, the men convicted of fatally beating John Hartman in 1997, are innocent. Polygraph expert David Raskin of Homer administered the test and presented Roberts' answers to key questions like,
did you participate in any way in the assault of John Hartman? Answered no.
Polygraphed results are generally not admissible in court, and it's unclear whether Judge Paul Lyle will consider them in ruling on the Fairbanks Four request for exoneration. The state attempted to discredit the polygraph results. Attorney Bob Linton took aim at the technology used to test Roberts. Raskin's wording of questions and the validity of the science itself, quoting from a 2002 National Research Council-funded polygraph study.
Almost a century of research in scientific psychology and physiology provides little basis for the expectation that a polygraph test could have extremely high accuracy. The physiological responses measured by the polygraph are not uniquely related to deception.
Raskin countered that the review did not include any polygraph scientists and that numerous laboratory studies show polygraphs to be 90% accurate. Linton characterized Raskin as a polygraph advocate who profits from the technology. Federal investigators have found the country's oldest theological college broke the law regarding its native art. Andover Newton Theological School planned to sell 80 pieces in its collection, including a sacred Tlingit halibut hook. Now some tribal leaders are wondering if repatriation laws should be tougher. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Rosita Worrell has been fighting against the school's native art liquidation since June. She's the president of Sealaska Heritage Institute, and also served on the NAGPRA Review Committee. That's the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. Worrell said the Fed's decision was bittersweet. It reaffirms the private college is subject to the law because it receives federal student loans.
And so we were happy, you know, that the federal government did find that they were obligated to comply with NAGPRA. But I was also saddened, you know, to think that we had to spend all of that time and effort to really force them.
Back in July, the school's president, Martin Copenhaver, maintained the items in the collection weren't sacred. Turns out, that's wrong. David Katzik, a Tlingit tribal member, identified the halibut hook as a sacred object that was used in religious ceremony. Copenhaver couldn't be reached for comment, but the college has 45 days to contest the decision.
To the best of my knowledge, we haven't received any request for informal discussion.
That's David Tarler. He works at the NAGPRA office in D.C.
And there has been no filing of a request for a hearing at this time.
Tarler said the college has reached out for technical assistance, but it should have filed a summary of its native art years ago. It allows the tribes to see what's in the collection. And Andover Newton might not be the only institution skipping this step. Worrell says the process can lead to oversights.
There's no real teeth to the law. I mean, if I did not file my income tax, you could be certain that I would be hearing from the federal government and there would be immediate action for me to comply with the law. In the case of NAGPRA, we don't have the similar kind of requirements.
Because of this, the Alaska Federation of Natives recently passed a resolution. A group will work on proposing amendments to NAGPRA. They've already reached out to the congressional delegation. Worrell says the changes are necessary. Repatriation can be a long and costly endeavor for the tribes.
In one case, I would say that we expended over $100,000 in just direct expenses with lawyers, other anthropologists, compiling evidence.
And she says the NAGPRA laws are more than 20 years old.
When museums and scientists were less sympathetic to Native American beliefs.
Worrell thinks there's been a cultural shift. Recently, the Northern Light United Church sent a letter to Andover Newton asking the school to return the sacred items. And with the advancements, she says the law should adapt too.
I do believe that we have a younger group of scientists, museum professionals that have a greater understanding. I mean, I've seen this, you know, happen through all of my work around the country.
Worrell hopes this case will encourage other schools and museums to step forward about their native collection. She says there are more legal hoops, but the Tlingit Halibut Hook is one step closer to coming home. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Sitka faces deeper ferry cuts than most port communities. The Alaska Marine Highway's draft schedule for next summer allows for only 2 port calls a week. That's way down from the 6 to 8 on the schedule this summer, Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Welcome aboard Alaska's Marine Highway and the new Fairweather class of ferries.
A safety video plays on screens in the front lounge of the fast ferry Chiniga. It's a message travelers in parts of Southeast and Prince William Sound have heard for the past 10 or so years. But it may not play again. The Alaska Marine Highway System plans to tie up the Chiniga and its sister ship, the Fairweather, as part of a larger budget-cutting plan. That and other service reductions will leave Sitka with only 2 ferry sailings a week, one to the north and one to the south.
It will harm us just like it's going to be harming much of the rest of Sitka.
Don Lehman is president of the Sitka Summer Music Festival's board of directors. He says the fast ferries, with their half-day sailings to and from Juneau, have made it easy for classical music fans to attend festival concerts.
Among other organizations, I think that with only 1 north and 1 south ferry, our patrons will not be able to utilize the ferry system at all.
That could affect businesses providing lodging, food, fishing charters, and tours to Sitka's visitors. One is Cinnamon Bear Bed and Breakfast, owned by Sylvia Frisky.
I'm thinking that it's going to be a very negative impact on our business, for sure, that people won't be able to have the convenience of that short trip to Sitka.
New ferry cuts, plus ones already in place, will affect a variety of other businesses and organizations. Then, there's school sports.
The cuts they've already made have had an impact, and the fact that they're going to make more cuts will have even a greater impact.
Sandy Wagner is Associate Director of the Alaska Schools Activities Association.
Getting to games is going to be almost impossible for some locations, and cost is going to skyrocket, and I foresee games being canceled and schedules having to change.
Tying up the fast ferries, plus 2 mainliners, are hitting more than Sitka. Wagner, who used to be Juneau's activities director, says scheduled cuts are making it hard for Kodiak and Cordova teams to travel, too. Of course, students, coaches, and chaperones can fly to their destinations, but schools are reducing or eliminating activities funding.
It's going to just increase the cost to, unfortunately, the have and have nots. The kids that can afford to fly, they'll be going. The kids that can't, won't.
Marine Highway officials are taking comments on the proposed ferry schedule through November 3rd. A statewide hearing on the schedule is planned for November 4th. Officials plan to finalize next summer's ferry schedule in December. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
Linfield College in Oregon offers degrees in the arts, sciences, and professional programs, and a rich campus life with athletics, music, study abroad, and more. Linfield College representatives are visiting area high schools in Anchorage, Kenai, and Fairbanks the week of October 20th. Learn more at linfield.edu. This message sponsored by Linfield College.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Jillian Rogers. This week on AK, Witness. Thousands travel from around the state to attend the Elders and Youth Conference and the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention each year. The week is considered by many as one of celebration, a time to see old friends and make new ones. This year was different. After numerous discussions throughout the week about Alaska's high rate of suicide, a man decided to take his own life in a very public way on the last day of the convention. Almost a week later, KTOO's Jennifer Canfield is still thinking about that moment and what happened after.
I've been going to the Elders and Youth Conference or the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention off and on since I was in middle school. These two annual events are like holidays, a week-long celebration with old friends and far-flung relatives. It's an opportunity for Alaska Natives to build consensus on issues and determine the AFN's agenda for the coming year. But some very difficult and emotionally draining conversations also take place during this time. Suicide is an issue, among others, that's typically addressed in some way at each year's convention.
When we look into the eyes of another person and can plainly see that their passion for life is missing or lacking for some reason, we must ask, how have we allowed this to become acceptable or even commonplace? We must ask, how can we help make things...
That's John Baker, the musher, announcing his initiative to address social problems in rural Alaska on Friday. He wants to recruit what he calls wellness ambassadors in every community across the state to offer help to those dealing with domestic violence, suicide, or drug and alcohol abuse. The day after Baker's announcement, something happened. I'm going to tell you the story of how I experienced the suicide that took place at the Denaina Convention Center Saturday. Not because I want to, but because I feel like I need to. The first thing I heard was what sounded like a gun going off, and then there were cries. I was on the third floor preparing for an interview. I ran over to the concourse railing with everyone else to see what had happened. I saw a man face down on the first floor. I still thought he must have been shot, until I overheard someone say that he'd jumped. A moment later, I turned my recorder on and pulled out my phone. I walked halfway down the stairs to a landing overlooking the scene below and took a picture. Denaina Center and AFN staff went after a photojournalist, trying to take away his camera before a police officer intervened.
Take the camera. Get the film. Get the film. No, take it. Take
it. A few minutes later, another reporter told me that a woman had collapsed on the floor after the man had jumped. I called my coworker in Juneau.
Jump off the top floor.
Oh my God, it's so f***ed up right now. Can you help write something right now?
Later that night, I visited with a few close friends, including one who was there. She said she heard someone desperately scream no as the man mounted the railing. I later watched the video of what was happening on stage at that time. AFN co-chair Anna Hoffman announced to the audience what had happened.
This ability of our languages to help us. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to interrupt here for a moment. There's been a tragic accident, and let's just stay very calm, and if we can stand and have a moment of silence. Please stay in this room if you can. There's been an accident outside of this room. There's a person who has just been deceased. So let's please stand and have a moment of silence.
I returned to my hotel early that night. I had work to do, but instead I lied on the bed with my shoes and jacket on and closed my eyes. I awoke suddenly, a few minutes later, jolted by a dream that the man was standing in front of me. This man whose face I'd never seen, whose voice I'd never heard. And I worried that maybe he'd changed his mind a second too late.
Holy God, holy mighty, holy mortal, have mercy on us. Holy God, holy mighty, holy mortal, have mercy on us. Holy God, holy mighty, holy mortal, have mercy on us. O most holy Trinity, have mercy on us. O Lord, cleanse us from our sins. O Lord, be with us at this moment and guide us and provide us comfort and strength.
Jennifer Canfield is a reporter and editor at KTOO in Juneau. Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Agatha Erickson, who lives in Anchorage and recalls a moose hunting adventure outside of Nenana with her ex-boyfriend a few years back.
Come about 3:30, the sun's going down, it's dusk, and we were just tired, we were cold, and we were just, okay, we're going to just go around this last slough, and if we don't see moose, then we're going to go back to Nana. We're about 25 miles outside of Nana at that point. And we round the corner to the slough, and there's this young moose. He shoots it. We start butchering around 4 o'clock, and butchered for the next 2 to 3 hours and covered in blood. And when you're butchering, it's really hot work. There's steam coming off the animal, and the temperature's dropping, and the northern lights are coming out, and the stars are coming out. And by the time we finish, it's probably about 6:37 and about 20 below. And unbeknownst to me, the boyfriend that I was with at the time forgot to put ISOHEAT in the machine, and we couldn't start it. We open up the hood, the sled, and there's ice on the lines. And we have to manually, with our mouths, blow out the ice. And we get about a half a mile out from where we killed and butchered the moose, and then it shuts down again. And so we blow it out. And we do that repeatedly until finally it becomes clear that the snow machine, can't actually pull the moose because of all of the ice in the machine, and it can only carry us. So we ditch the sled, and for the next 20, 25 miles back to Nana, about every couple of miles we had to stop, blow the ice out of the lines and the starter until we get back to Nana. And then we called a friend to come rescue us and get the moose on the new sled and come back, and we start our drive back to Fairbanks, and I think we got back around 6 a.m. the next day. So it was, all in all, a 24-hour moose hunt. It was delicious. I definitely would say that I've savored that moose more than other mooses. And we turned it into burger, steak, or roasts, and I think we even made sausage out of it.
Agatha Erickson lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK. We had help this week from Jennifer Canfield, Zachariah Hughes, Annie Fite, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Jillian Rogers.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz and Monica Goki in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, and Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Learn more about Alaska Pacific University during a 3-day weekend experience October 30th to November 1st. Experience the campus and Anchorage while discovering how APU can map out your educational adventure by attending courses, participating in activities, and interacting with faculty and other students. Register at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.